Good morning, everyone. Judge Sykes and I are so privileged this morning to have with us Judge Thomas Durkin of the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. So you're going to all have to be on your best behavior. Okay? All right. Here we go. Case number one is Thale versus Midland National, and it's appeal 13-1272 and 13-2366. And Mr. Stuvey, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Stuvey. Good morning. Come on up.
All right.
I always feel like the price is right. Come on up.
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Stevie. I'm here on behalf of the appellant. The district court's summary judgment ruling that the only reasonable interpretation of Taos policy is that neither the based on clause with its five specific mortality factors nor the explicit expense caps precluded Midland from adding undisclosed expense add-ons into the cost of insurance charge cannot survive de novo review.
I want to ask you something right off the bat. From your perspective, is there any material difference between the policy language that is at issue in Norum and the policy language that's at issue here?
Both policies make clear that there are two limitations in the cost of insurance charge. One is that it cannot exceed the maximum guarantee, and number two, that it must be based on mortality risk, specifically based on the five mortality factors that are identified in the policies. Those are identical. The other similarity is, just like the court there, this court ignored what a reasonable insured would understand these provisions to mean, the based on provision and the expense caps. The district court's opinion here renders both provisions meaningless, and it violates well-established doctrine under Wisconsin law that a specific mention in a contract of one or more matters excludes other matters of the same nature or class not expressly mentioned. That's exactly what we've been able to demonstrate here through the COI Solver Workbook. We lay those out in 14, 15, and 17. And these are the smoking guns in this case. They clearly establish that what Midland did is they first came up with a mortality component, which is the pricing mortality times the select factor, which is a reduction based on whether or not you're a smoker or a non-smoker, which is also expressly permitted by the contract. And they came up with a product, which is the mortality rate that they should have used to set the cost of insurance rate. But on top of that, they added what they called at the time, Your Honor, an expense add-on, which there's no dispute that it is unrelated to mortality. And that is in direct violation of both the based-on clause as well as the expense caps. Because those additional expenses that they added on, and we set this out in our brief, is resulted in a $41 overcharge in the first year, which is double the explicit expense caps that are allowed under the expense amount. They doubled it.
Yeah, but that's my fourth but. But is it fair to say that the cost of insurance rate is in fact based on the five named factors in the sense that those five factors are used to identify where within Midland's tables or matrix a particularized insured is placed. In other words, the name factors are used, and they are used in an important way, aren't they?
The five factors are in fact used to come up with the pricing mortality and the select factor that results in the product. If they had stopped there, Your Honor, There would be no breach in this case. There would be no injury. But what they did, and the COI solvers make it clear, is that they then added an expense add-on that they even concede, and the trial court recognizes, is unrelated to mortality, that more than triples what the cost of insurance charge should have been if they had relied on the five factors mandated by the contract.
Let me just bother you once more, because it seems to me you want us to read based on to mean exclusively based on. Is that correct?
No, I want you to read based on to mean what it says, which is that it's based on the five factors. And what Goble makes clear under Wisconsin law... What it means is, you don't have to add that word in, though, because it exclusively is implied, because when you say it's based on and then you include five specific mortality factors, you are then precluded from using a factor unrelated to mortality, and there's no dispute here that that's in fact what they did, to substantially increase the cost of insurance charge. And this is critical in the context of a universal life policy, because, and that's why they unbundle the charges and put limitations on those charges, because they first take a 20% premium load off the top of your premium payment, and then these monthly deductions that are separated out and have limitations are deducted, and what you have left over is what accumulates value down the road. And so it's very important to an insured that those limitations are in fact followed. And this case best illustrates why. Because if you allow Midland to do what it did, it has substantially loaded undisclosed expenses in the cost of insurance charge, which they tell regulators is in fact a mortality rate. That's what it's supposed to be. It's designed to cover mortality risk, and they tell regulators that the cost of insurance charge is independent of the unit expense charge, and that's critical here. Because if you allow them to take expenses that exceed the expense cap, which is supposed to be separately designated, and lump them in to the mortality charge, you're not treating those two charges separately and distinct. And so what they have done violates both the expense caps and the cost of insurance charge.
Don't insurance companies have costs that are going to contribute to the cost of an individual insurance policy?
They do. And the way you capture those is they have a 20% premium that they take right off the top of every premium payment. And then they have an expense mount and a cost of insurance charge or mortality charge. If they want to add additional undisclosed expenses like they loaded into the cost of insurance charge, they need to say so. And that's simply what our case is all about. If you're going to do what they did, and that's what Goble makes clear under Wisconsin law, that if you're going to do what they did, you have to say so. You have to get authorization under the policy to do so, and they've not done it.
So in other words, your contention is, I take it, that everything Midland includes in the expense add-on to the cost of insurance should be included in the separate expense amount.
It should have been should have been identified somewhere in the policy. And the point is that no reasonable insurer would construe those monthly deduction provisions and understand that Midland is going to load undisclosed expenses in the mortality charge. There's nothing in the cost of insurance rate description. There's nothing in the expense caps that allows them to do that. And no reasonable insured would interpret it that way. The trial court's interpretation, the court says undoubtedly that's the only interpretation. It can't be the only reasonable interpretation. If you consider what an insured would be relying on and understanding in reading these monthly deduction provisions.
Other than the plaintiff herself, though, is there any expert testimony in the record which puts forth an industry standard that differs from what Midland has here?
Well, the point is, there is expert testimony from our expert, which, by the way, the trial court completely ignores, never cites, that makes it clear
She considered it. In her summary judgment opinion, she said she considered it.
Right, but doesn't cite to it. Our expert, an actuary, says if you're going to, that it's an actuarial standard, that if you're going to include expense add-ons, into the mortality charge or the cost of insurance charge, you have to so state in the policy, and they didn't.
Well, that's an actuary, but is there someone in the insurance industry that states that what Midland did here is contrary to industry standard or industry practice?
Well, we didn't. That wasn't debated in the lower court because the question is what a reasonable insured would understand the contract provision to mean. So the question is not from the insurer's perspective, and the case law makes that very clear. It's from the insurer's perspective. What would they understand when there are these separately designated expense caps, and they say that their expense amount will not be more than that, and then the cost of insurance charge, which even Midland concedes is a mortality risk, would a reasonable insured understand that under the mortality charge, they would load an undisclosed expense load that nearly triples the explicit expenses on the expense amount? And I would submit that is not what a reasonable insured would understand those policy provisions to mean. And that's why the trial court should be reversed. That's why it's error as a matter of law. And the Goebel decision, if there's any doubt, makes that very clear, that if you're going to specifically state what the customer insurance rate is based on, you can't then add something that's not specified to that. And not only did they do that here, but even the trial court had to acknowledge that the expense add-on is unrelated to mortality. It should not have been put in to the mortality charge. The other thing that I'll point out, and the regulators require them, and the cite to this is at Joint Appendix 264-65, regulators require Midland to separately state the expense charges and the mortality charges that are deducted from the monthly deductions on an annual basis. It contradicts those requirements as well to allow Midland to bury expenses in the mortality charge component when those are designated. No reasonable insured would understand that. Now, I want to get to the class certification. Our arguments there are the following. Number one, the court clearly applied the wrong commonality standard and therefore abused its discretion. The court found that the policy language at issue was the same for all class members and would be interpreted uniformly across the class. There was a common question existed in this case, which was whether Midland acted contrary to that language, and that the answer to that question would be common across the class. That's what the court found.
Would you agree that it would clearly benefit the insurance company at this point to have class certification, and yet the insurance company is not seeking class certification?
They actually oppose class certification.
Right.
But the commonality requirement certainly was met, and the court should have stopped right there and certified it. But what the court did, and this is what's particularly troubling, is several times in his opinion.
Well, you haven't addressed the other factors. You've addressed commonality, but I don't see you addressing the other.
Well, that was the only factor that the trial court addressed was commonality. But Your Honor, I will address the other points that the trial court made.
But you didn't. So that's kind of waived, isn't it?
I'm sorry. The denial of class certification was based on the fact that we did not meet the commonality requirement. And we submit that the court erred in finding that we did not meet the commonality requirement. So the court didn't evaluate typicality or the other grounds that Midland argues on appeal because they know that the court's ruling was wrong with respect to commonality. But here's what's particularly troubling. If you look at the court's findings, he states numerous times that one of the principal reasons why there's no commonality is because some policyholders may prefer the interpretation that Midland has. And this is at Joint Appendix 13, and it's at 18 again. And he basically says that many policyholders prefer paying higher rates. That, of course, would be absurd. So what the court says is many policyholders would prefer to pay higher rates in earlier policy years in exchange for lower rates in later in life. One reason why they may prefer the shape of the cost of insurance curve is that there are certain tax advantages. And he cites to paragraph 50 of Mr. Bill's affidavit. And I'd ask the court to review that because Mr. Bill's paragraph 50 does not say that policyholders would prefer paying higher rates. It doesn't say anything close to that. What it says is, and I quote, the larger premiums in earlier years helped to lower premiums in later years, and this may be advantageous to some policyholders. The potential advantage derives in part from the income tax rules applicable to life insurance. That's the only paragraph the court cites to support its conclusion that many policyholders would prefer higher rates. What Mr. Bill was saying there is not inconsistent at all with our theory of the case. We're saying that they overcharged the cost of insurance rate, which reduced the net premium that would ultimately accumulate value. This is a flexible premium policy. You can put in as much premium up front as you want, and you don't have to do that, and at the same time accept being overcharged for cost of insurance rate.
Well, do you disagree with the idea that some policyholders may prefer lower premiums later when they may have less income?
No, but our point is you can pay higher premiums without being overcharged with the cost of insurance rate. That's what the court completely misses here.
The problem is that your reading of the contract is materially adverse to some of the class members. I think that's the main point here.
But our point is it's not, because there is nothing that prevents a policyholder.
It alters the way that the premiums are calculated, which is beneficial to some members of the class but adverse to others.
That's assuming you accept the policy rates that were not contained in the cost of insurance solver that the trial court ultimately adopts on. But even with those, even if you accept those rates, and this is critical, for the first 15 years, the policyholders are in fact overcharged for the cost of insurance. And then the last 15 years, they're not damaged by our interpretation. Midland's simply in compliance with the contract. Their cost of insurance rates do not exceed the price of mortality for the last 15 years. So there is no conflict that the court attempts to find here. At best, it's speculative. There's nothing in the record in which supports that many policyholders would prefer Midland's interpretation. The only paragraph, the only record that the court cites when he makes this finding is paragraph 50. And paragraph 50 says that larger premiums may be preferred by policyholders. And our point is larger premiums can be paid by policyholders without having to incur a inflated cost of insurance rate. Our interpretation, in fact, is completely consistent with that position, because by reducing the cost of insurance rate, you're increasing the accumulated value that is building earlier in the years, in the early years, that will help pay for the premiums later in life. That's our whole point, is the damage here. By the overcharge in the first 15 years, you substantially reduce the cash value that would build up, that would be paying the premiums in future years. So the conflict that the court has found is not based on the record. In fact, Mr. Bill's paragraph 50 does not support his conclusion. It's a speculative conflict, and therefore class certification
I do want to remind you that you are deep into your rebuttal.
I will. The only other thing that I would like to point out is on point number 3, record document 82-9 makes clear that Midland told us before we filed our motion to compel that the actual and expected mortality documents that we were seeking had not been produced to us, and that's why we moved to compel those documents, because they directly refuted their position at class certification. It's 82-9, page 2. Trial court does not even recognize that golden rule communication to us when we moved to compel. We were clearly entitled to move to compel because it directly refuted the position they were taking in the case. The court abused its discretion in denying the motion to compel, and then on top of that made matters worse by ordering us to pay $50,000 when we sought that directly relevant evidence.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Martin?
Thank you, Your Honor. James Martin for Midland. Your Honors, I want to start with a point that globally I think applies to the argument that the court just heard, and that is that much of it depends on a redrafting of our policy for terms and conditions that aren't in it and much of it contradicts the record, which establishes what Midland does, why it does it, and in particular with respect to the COI solver, which was described as the smoking gun. So the word of caution is that our construction here is fairly straightforward, starting with the policy.
It's terrible for me to interrupt you at this point, but I want to ask you the same question that I started out with for Mr. Steve, and that is, from your perspective, are there any material differences in the language of the policy that's at issue at Norham and the policy that is at issue here?
I am not fully conversant in the Norham policy. I know it only from the opinion that I read that we have cited in our case. But as to what's reflected in the opinion, I think there are two material differences that make our case and the construction of our policy stronger for the construction that Midland is urging. The first is provision 7.8 in our policy, which we've highlighted in our briefing, and which makes clear that the cost of insurance rates can indeed be based on more than just these mortality characteristics. And also provision 5.6 or section 5.6 of the policy, which structurally shows that plaintiff's interpretation, which would require just the exclusive listed mortality factors to produce some specified rate, is at odds with the structure of our policy. The third point that I would make where our case is potentially stronger than Norham is on the record. We provided declarations and exhibits to the court that demonstrated how the actuarial calculations were made that supported Midland's construction of the policy. These were expert declarations that explained the cost of insurance, the rates, the COI solver, and, in fact, how the characteristics were used to give us our construction based on. And, Your Honor, you're right. They are the organizing principles of the tables that select the rates. They are the foundation of how the rates are determined for particular policyholders. And certainly that meets the ordinary definition of based on, which is what we're relying on. I'd like to just go through a few other things that came up in this argument.
Before you do, do you think it's relevant that there's a separate expense charge provided for in the policy? In other words, wouldn't one expect that all expenses would be accounted for there rather than as an additional unnamed factor in the cost of insurance? Because the plaintiff seems to think that your interpretation of the policy language would permit Midland to double charge for the same expenses. And I think you should address that concern if you wouldn't mind.
I would be happy to, Your Honor. First of all, that expense amount is not an expense cap as it was described or an expense add-on. It is a charge under the policy that is made once at the beginning of the policy period, and it's linked to the specified amount of the policy, which is the death benefit. It has no correlation to Midland's expenses by its terms, in other words, overhead expenses or other things. And second, it has no correlation to Midland's expenses in the way that it operates. If we are going to look at the expense amount provision as it relates to the cost of insurance in dispute, the argument also becomes stronger because there is no hint in the provision that it relates to Midland's cost of insurance expenses. They don't go back and forth. The expense amount is a separate charge that is made to the policyholder. The cost of insurance rates is an independent charge. And if you look at 7.7 and 7.8, they do not relate to the expense amount expressly, except to treat it independently in 7.8. And if you look at the expense amount provision, it does not relate to the cost of insurance or describe that as being correlated to the cost of insurance. So I think when the reasonable insured reads this policy, they are not going to form the impression that those two are interrelated because the policy cuts against it. As to this double-dipping notion, the record is expressed in Mr. Bill's declaration. It's at the joint appendix, I think it's 207 to 209, that Midland doesn't double-dip, that this expense creature argument is a figment of the plaintiff's imagination. The expense amount is explained in Mr. Bill's declaration, as I said. It is a single charge made once at the beginning of the policy, at the time of purchase. It extends for 74 years under the terms of the policy, and it is not correlated to any year-by-year expense determination that would be made.
So which is the one-time assessment and which is the annual assessment? The expense,
yes.
I mean, the policy uses two different terms, expense charge and expense amount.
The expense amount has two pieces to it, a policy charge and a unit charge, and that together is made once and set at the beginning of the policy, and it's referred to on the policy benefits page. The cost of insurance is a monthly, and it varies because of the structure and design of this particular insurance product. That's why it has to change, because the variables that go into the calculation of the rate change with policyholder behavior. Plaintiff talked about the notion of what Wisconsin law would want here, referring to the Goble case. Goble is off point. If the court takes a close look at it, which I know it will, in Goble, the insurer changed the provision in the policy. It wasn't about interpreting the language that was there or applying it. It was a change in the language of the policy that increased the loan amount. Everyone would agree that that kind of thing is prohibited by Wisconsin law, but it's not what's going on here. Under Wisconsin law, the dictionary or ordinary definition of based on fits very neatly into what Midland does with its calculations here on the rates that it selects. And Wisconsin law, including an opinion from this court, would adopt that ordinary definition, and it would be perceived by the ordinary insured as the correct thing to do. The COI Solver workbook, the so-called smoking gun, Mr. Bill had three separate declarations in this case on class cert, on summary judgment, and in opposition to plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. And he explained very carefully that the COI Solver is not a mortality calculation, and that the expense add-on in the COI Solver is not related to mortality calculations at all. And not only that, the expense add-on in the COI Solver does not relate to Midland's overhead expenses or other things at all. It's an actuarial use of a descriptive term to make a calculation to help price the products. It's a spreadsheet. The Bill and Wilcox declarations describe this at length. They're unrefuted. They were properly relied on by the trial court.
Is Tao correct when she represents that 85% of the cost of insurance derives from the expense add-on rather than the five factors that are identified in the policy?
That is what I will call either misdirection or misdescription or both. She's not correct because that whole argument comes from the COI Solver, which is not related to the expenses or the charge, the rates that the plaintiff is talking about. So the plaintiff is taking an expense add-on from a Midland spreadsheet that is not related to mortality calculations at all, and is using that as though if you applied that to her cost of insurance rates, they're somehow divided by mortality and expenses. So it's corrupting the document that she's relying on. If you took that expense add-on and tried to use it to calculate the costs of insurance, you are already using the COI Solver add-on for something that it's not intended for at all. to say it a different way, you can't simply take that expense add-on piece out of the COI solver and correlate it the way that the plaintiff does to a division between mortality characteristics and Midland's expenses. It's not intended to address that, and it doesn't address it by definition. The COI solver workbook, in essence, Your Honor, and probably the easiest answer to this, it's not a mortality calculation. It doesn't help that analysis at all. It is an actuarial spreadsheet that helps actuaries decide how they're going to cost the policy. If you take pieces of the COI solver and extract them out and try to make that a calculation that reflects Midland's mortality expectations or experience, you are using that document fundamentally for a purpose for which it was never intended, and the record on that is uncontradicted. The COI solver should not be part of this analysis for any purpose, Your Honor, including this 85% comparison that the plaintiff invents by using it for an improper purpose.
Do you agree we should put ourselves in the shoes of a reasonable insured when we interpret 7.7?
Yes. And I think if you do that, Your Honor, you get to the place that I described before, that based on means it's a foundation, it's a consideration, it's just what it is. It's the central focus of how these rates get set. In fact, Your Honor, it is the way that we treat all insureds alike and prohibit discrimination among similarly situated insureds.
Does Tao's deposition create a factual issue, though?
Not on that, Your Honor. Not on the construction of the contract. The provision, I think, if it's read as a reasonable insured would read it, her subjective interpretation can't change that.
Well, and that's black letter Wisconsin insurance law too. It's an objective test, not a subjective test.
Yes, agreed, Your Honor. Two other things came up in the argument that I want to address quickly, maybe three if I have time. One was this, that Midland had staked out a position with insurance regulators that's somehow contrary to the argument that it's making in court today. That comes from a letter written to the Puerto Rico insurers. That was in front of the district court. It was not considered to be relevant by the district court, and for good reason. It was extrinsic to the policy, and more importantly, it doesn't establish what the plaintiff claims that it does. The letter was written to the Puerto Rico insurer insurance regulator for a different purpose and addressing the mortality rates in the table, not the mortality rates that are set under the cost of insurance provision in the policy. And, of course, what Midland had to say about the mortality insurance rates in the table to the Puerto Rico regulators was exactly right. They're based on mortality, and they are. The table in the policy is a standard industry mortality table. But it's not apples to apples here, because what we are dealing with is not the tables, but the way Midland sets its cost of insurance rates. There was some mention about the record support for the district court's class action determination and the nature of the conflict that is here. There is far more than the reference made by the district court in its opinion behind this conflict. There are declarations from Dr. Merrill and Mr. Wilcox that establish that at the time these policies are purchased, decisions are made by policyholders on their expectations for the policy, and that these conflicts arise at the time of purchase, and there is nothing speculative about them. If you intend to hold this policy for a long time, pay the premiums to keep the policy fund in force, your position is in conflict with the plaintiff's. The district court found that it was right, and that defeats commonality under the law that we've cited in our a brief. There also was more to the reasons the class cert should be denied here, which we emphasized in our brief and which were not addressed. But this conflict issue, the district court didn't make it up. It was founded in the record and is dependent on examples and curves that we put in our brief to show how this spread occurs. Now, the plaintiff has tried to solve that here at argument by saying, well, we'll use my idea in the front end and Midland's idea on the back end. That doesn't work. There is only one way to do this, and that's either using Midland's approach or the plaintiff's. The plaintiff's approach creates the conflict. Midland's approach follows through on what the policy provides.
Does the conflict, or is the conflict issue more appropriately analyzed as a problem of typicality rather than commonality?
It could be, but the way that it relates to commonality, I think, under the case law as I read it, is that it goes to the relief sought, and if there are class-wide conflicts in the relief sought, that can also relate to commonality. Ms. Tao's typicality problem also is a little bit different or goes beyond the commonality issue itself. She has a no-lapse guarantee policy, and this conflict doesn't hit her quite as hard or need not hit her quite as hard. And as we briefed in the district court, that is an issue for her on the commonality side. The last thing that I wanted to talk about, let's see, I got my notes are a little scrambled here, had to do with this whole notion of the discovery ruling. And the plaintiff has suggested here at argument and suggests in their briefs that there was a piece of correspondence from Midland's counsel that was the holy grail and should have been credited by the district court to show that Midland, in fact, hadn't produced its mortality information and that it was an abuse of discretion for the judge to sanction. That correspondence and the reference in the correspondence has been taken out of context by the plaintiff. It doesn't accomplish what the plaintiff said in the briefing. And most importantly, it was before the district court on the motion to reconsider. It was the centerpiece of the argument. The district court saw that it was taken out of context based on our briefing and exercised its discretion finally in light of that. And so that decision certainly is within the realm of reason, and Your Honors deserves to be affirmed. Plaintiff made
I want to take you somewhere else.
Sure.
Why is it that Midland doesn't want class certification? I mean, given everyone's agreement that there is a question common to all class members, I would think at this point you would want class-wide determination more than they do. More than Thayil does.
Your Honor, I think that Midland's position on class certification is probably like most defendants that I represent. We don't want any part of it for any reason, even if we were able to use it to get that kind of ruling. We could never use that offensively anyway. So there isn't really any upside to us in a class cert here, and we would be very happy to have class cert denied.
That is so honest. Nice.
Unless the court has more questions, we'd be happy to submit.
Thank you very much. How much time is left? 1 minute.
Counsel repeatedly states that it's unrefuted, their interpretation of the COY solvers. It wasn't. We vehemently controvert their attempts to recast what the cost of insurance solvers say. Our expert's opinion is from 149 to 168. I'd ask the court to review it. Remember, this is on summary judgment. It should. Number two is, Your Honor, they cannot respond to your question about the expense caps. The expense amount, they say, will be no more than that. There is no question if you look at the plain meaning of the COY solvers, as our expert actuary confirms, they've added an expense add-on that's buried in the cost of insurance charge, and that is in violation of the expense caps. The trial court couldn't...
Isn't that expressly authorized by Section 7.8 of the policy?
It is not.
That's a broad reservation of the right of the insurer to alter the COI rates based on changes in future expectations.
But it's expectations as to mortality with respect to the COI
and
rate.
And investment earnings, persistency, and expenses.
But those tie to each of the monthly deductions. So future changes in expenses, then you can change expenses, future changes to mortality. Our expert addresses that in his report, by the way. That's an attempt to take out of context what 7.8 means. There's no question that the expense amount means what it says. It can't be more than what they say it's going to be, and they're burying these expenses in the cost for insurance charge or the mortality rate as a violation of the policy. We'd ask that the trial court's summary judgment ruling be reversed, class certification be reversed, and certification be granted, and that the order imposing sanctions against us for seeking clearly relevant information should be reversed. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks to one and all. The case will be taken under advisement, and you all.